So this is continuing with Grote Reber on 25th October 75, and he told me that at the Greenbank dish, the metal structures, support structures, are original, but the surface is new, and all of the wooden parts are new. So continuing through your 1958 article about the early days, you say you first tried at 9 centimeters, mm-hmm. and your reasoning was that if it was thermal radiation, a high frequency should have much more stronger signal, as well as giving you a higher resolution. And you say that an RCA type 103A end plate magnetron was acquired for general testing. And I wanted to ask you, when you say it was acquired, does that mean that you were able to borrow one from the company, or did you always have to go out and buy all this stuff?
Circumstances were different in that day, in that we had salesmen that came around and tried to sell a product, and these were pretty able and intelligent and aggressive people who knew their product, they knew their company, and they had good liaison with not only the management but with the factory.
Mm-hmm.
Today you get salesmen that don't know their product, they don't know anything, see? They can't even find anything in a catalog. Well, in any case, in that day, there were these salesmen came around, and they were pretty good. And the local radio industry there, a fella could come around in the morning, and you wanted a special kind of a switch or a capacitor or something, and by God, frequently you'd get it in the afternoon. Because he'd just ring his factory and say, now, modify so-and-so, and I'll pick it up. Well, in this A103 magnetron, RCA was, of course, sending its reps around.
Right.
And I talked to them not only about what they were trying to sell Stuart Warner, but other things which they might have. And they were pretty able, that is, that they, of course they wouldn't phone New Jersey, but in a few days when they were back, they'd have some literature for me about some experimental thing being made in the Harrison Tube Labs or something. Mm-hmm. And one of these things turned out to be this magnetron. And so I asked them how much they wanted for one, and they already had a price that experimentally they'd sell them, I think, for $30 a piece or something. So I bought one.
I see.
So, but I found out about it again through this preferred position.
Right.
That I had good contacts with the electronics industry.
And it really was critical to doing all of these experiments.
That's right.
Well, going back to the dish momentarily, I had a note here. What was the total final cost of the dish? Did you ever add up?
I don't remember exactly, but it was on the order of $1,000. Not very much.
Which is incredibly cheap. I mean,
yeah, but
even at that time. I mean, because all of your own labor
you
put into
it. But think, $1,000 would have bought a brand new Ford car.
But what kind of a dish can you build now for the equivalent of a Ford car?
Right.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, that's true. In other words, for the price of a Ford car today, you couldn't get anything.
Right. Okay, now, then you, moving on further, you talk about a Barkhausen tube was tried, and you say the vacuum tube construction work was done by the glass experts at the University of Chicago.
Yes.
I was wondering how you arranged that. Was that through being a graduate student there?
Yes. They had, this fellow's name I don't remember anymore, but they mainly built things like flasks and pipes and
sure.
junk for the chemistry laboratory and things
like that. Yeah, all old physics gardens used to have glass blowers. And
typical kind of a glass lab a university would have.
Right.
And I got all the metal parts and just had them put it together.
I see.
And incidentally, they built me a small diode, too. I don't know whether that's mentioned in there or not.
Now, we come to the summer of 38, when you tried these 3300 megahertz mm-hmm. observations, and as you say, all this was rather dampening to the enthusiasm when you didn't get any signals, and I can imagine that's true. But nevertheless, you continued to go on. Was the idea that you had invested so much in the dish that you certainly weren't going to give up with just the first receiver, or?
Well, partly that. But you don't forget, I had in front of me Jansky's results. So it wasn't just a question of hunting wisps in the dark. Here was some positive evidence.
Right.
And true, I was doing different things. And the mere fact that I got nothing didn't necessarily prove that nothing was there. See, here was very good evidence there was something there. See? Now, I was at a very different wavelength by some 40 times or something. And consequently, what came out of this, I think, as I mentioned, was simply that the phenomena certainly didn't follow Planck's black body radiation law.
Right.
Well, nobody knew. Nobody had any idea about what law it might be. Might even be an inverse one.
Yeah.
So I had made a bad guess. That's all.
And you knew that if you went low enough, eventually you must detect it. So it's a question of how high could you detect it at.
Exactly.
Now, this is a general question about all of this, and I gather that you've been through your archives recently. Are all of the logbooks and everything, all of these things still existing from these early observations?
Oh yeah, I've looked at a lot of them very recently.
And are they, you just mentioned that many of them are in Tasmania. Do you have
some? They're all there now.
They're all in Tasmania?
Yeah, they're all down there now.
Including old equipment that you...
everything. It was in storage a long time in Jersey when I couldn't get a hold of it or use it. And when I decided I was going to be down there for a while, I had the Research Corps send everything down there.
I see.
They were paying big storage fees on the damn stuff. It wasn't doing anybody any good. Nobody could get any access to it. And I thought, all right, let's quit pumping money down that drain.
Right.
And bring it down to where I can do something with it, which was a very fortunate thing since they wanted me to give this lecture on all this old stuff.
Right.
And I had this opportunity now to dig it out and look at it and examine it. And as I say, most all of it's in quite good shape.
Great. The old photographs of that you took of the antennas and the various receivers and stuff. Man, I got to get down to Tasmania somehow to see all this.
Well, I have a couple I brought with me. A funny thing happened. But some of these old photographs were taken with this camera that was given to me when I was maybe about 12.
Oh, the one you told me about, yeah.
And peculiar enough, it's an ancient camera that you can't get the film for anymore, but apparently has a very good lens, has long f-ratio.
Uh-huh.
And so it took very sharp photographs, and all these old negatives were very sharp, even the ones taken indoor.
Hmm.
Except for a few that were taken by my good mother. And she pressed the button with a great vigor, and so the damn thing got blurred.
Right.
And I saved them because I have a pack rat like that.
Right.
And just in the past couple of months, an article came out in Science about de-blurring photographs.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
So I have torn that article out, and I have taken out two that I thought might be worth reconstructing, and I have folded them all together in an envelope. And when I get to Green Bank, I'm going to have the director there write to this bunch and say, would they de-blur a couple of these photographs?
Because they're of historical interest.
So you have to get a positive response on that.
That's beautiful. Okay, moving on here. Okay, so you have these photographs. You talk here about you had provision to rotate the drum to measure polarization if necessary, which is, I think is sort of an amazing step also. Mm-hmm. Were you expecting that this radiation might be polarized, or?
Not really, but you see, going to school I learned about polarized light, and in optics, in astronomy, by that day there had been some polarization measurements, particularly in relation to the solar corona and so on. And so, without having to go to a lot of complexity, it seemed that it would be worthwhile to include in this general development some provision for checking polarization.
Right. Did you ever make any such measurements?
No. It's easy. See, this is circular.
Right.
All you do is turn it.
Right. Okay, and I suppose that you have the very first records where you got a positive detection amongst your archives. Well, I really would like to see that someday. Now, you use the interesting term, these preliminary results were published in 1940. The intensity was guessed at by noting the effective resistance shunts across the first tuned circuit. No calibrated signal generator was available then. Now, by saying guessed at, I think you're trying to imply that it was very crude. And do you mean an order of magnitude sort of thing?
Yeah, really? I should get it within. But what happened, you see, is that I don't have a picture of that signal generator, but I've taken pictures. See, in order to get anything lined up, you got to have some signal generator. So what I built was an oscillator that was really adjustable. Now, this is different than tunable. So I adjusted the oscillator to some frequency, which I thought was suitable, using an electric wire. And then I tuned the receiver to that oscillator. And that receiver shown there is this...
In the 1940 article, right.
Yeah. That receiver just has multiple single-tuned circuits. So you just synchronize them all.
Right. See?
So that was easy. And then you came up with... an output depending on the amount of fluctuation noise in the first tuned circuit. So then you put a resistor across the first tuned circuit, noted what happened to the output.
Right.
And from this you could guess what the sensitivity was going to be. That's all. So it was a guess, you know,
right,
an order of magnitude thing.
Right.
It was only, see, now this, that was all built before there was any results. So
yeah.
I didn't go overboard buying hundreds of dollars worth of test gear.
Sure, sure.
Or building very fancy test gear.
You didn't consider it that important to pin down the negative result that accurately.
No, I mean, no. Hey. After I got some results, then that changed the whole picture. Now that we got some results, let us find out with more precision just what all this is about.
Right.
And then I built a real good signal generator. That I think I mentioned.
Yeah, right, you do.
I've got pictures of that. None were ever published, I think, but I took some pictures.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that the next paper, published in 1944, included a polar diagram of the antenna pattern taken on the strong source in Cassiopeia. And indeed, that's, as we talked about, the best way to get your antenna pattern. But did you realize that at the time? Apparently not, because then you wouldn't have been quoting these
probably not, at least not in the beginning.
Because you didn't realize, of course, it wasn't known that Cass was a point source to begin with.
No.
So I think that's the trouble.
The antenna pattern was certainly no bigger than that. No, I think, in honesty, I didn't realize that Cass was telling me that this was the antenna pattern.
That it could be no bigger than that, like you say.
No bigger.
Yeah.
Because those other sources down the line were shown on that same set of contours are all bigger than Cass.
Right. But it still could have been smaller than as you thought it was from your models.
I suppose.
So it was consistent with what you thought, certainly.
It was consistent.
If you'd found a source in the sky that was only 1 degree in size, then you would have known that something
was
astray.
So I didn't find anything smaller than what the theoretical pattern should have been.
Right. Yeah. And as you told me in the letter, apparently you went astray using some models.
Right.
Maybe you could just tell me that. Again, exactly how you try to determine the antenna pattern.
Well, I don't remember the details of that, but it wasn't done at any such at that frequency. It was done at the microwaves.
With the 9 centimeter.
No. Yeah, with the 9 centimeter thing. See. And I had a crystal detector in it. And the crystal detector was a very nonlinear device.
Right.
These things have more importance today than they did then. At that time, I didn't worry about these matters. The question was whether I could get anything or
right,
not.
Right, right. Yeah.
And we'll worry about all this kind of stuff once I get something to measure.
Sure.
There's nothing to measure.
Sure, sure. No, I agree with you totally, but you can see, of course, where it's of interest now to try to see exactly how it developed. And especially, for instance, when you had some bumps that you thought were the Andromeda Nebula, but in fact,
they were just drifts.
They were narrower than your antenna could possibly have
that's right.
picked up.
That's right.
As Van der Waals pointed out first.
Yeah.
So it would have been useful to you in that respect, anyway.
Yeah, I think I tried to correct that in here somewhere, didn't I? Mention somewhere that...
In this article?
Yeah, toward the end.
I don't remember. Let's just go through here, maybe. The next point I have here is that when you detected the sun in 1943, that if the source, the radio source, were a size of the optical disc, a half a degree, that you'd have a temperature of about a million degrees. And you say this had no meaning at the time. And I think it's also true that you did not point it out at the time when you made your measurement.
No, I didn't.
Did you realize this, that it was so... at the time, did you make any such calculations at that time?
No. I pointed out that it had an intensity similar to what the intensity was in Sagittarius.
Right.
And as far as converting it back to temperature on a disk, no.
Right.
No. So I just pointed out at that time that it was far in excess of anything that might be expected. That is orders of magnitude.
Right, right. I wanted to ask you about now working at 480 megahertz. You talk about even before the four-stage amplifier was finished, it was clear that it would be rather ineffective. By using special dispensation, I secured some GE 446B lighthouse tubes in 45. What does that mean?
Well, see, this was just at the end of the war. And most of all this stuff was still classified in some manner or another.
Yeah.
And there was a very limited production of these lighthouse tubes for certain radar things. They were used, I believe, local oscillators. And consequently, they weren't an open market thing.
I see.
But again, through my connections in the radio industry, I was able to get these things, the same as I got those orbital beam multipliers.
I see.
And I got others. There's a sample I picked out of one of the boxes called a beam deflection mixer. It was never used.
Mm-hmm.
But I got an assortment of this stuff through those channels.
Now, when you first picked up the burst from the sun, and this was in 46, I think, summer of 46, am I this right?
I guess so.
Yeah.
Sounds like it.
And this is what you were describing to me earlier about... Well, it's about that time anyway, when you had some visitors down there and they came in the side lobes.
That's right. Solar activity was rising.
Now, were you reading Nature at that time? Did you know that, had you seen Hayes' thing and the quasi things?
I didn't learn about Hay until after I got to Washington, 1947 or 8.
Really? I see. So you were operating completely independent.
Apparently.
Also of Pawsey's group?
Yeah. I don't seem to remember much about that. I'm pretty sure I didn't remember about Hay until later. If I did, it was just before I left Wheaton.
Hmm.
When did Hay publish his stuff?
Right after the war ended, in early 46.
46.
Early 46. And Pawsey's first paper was also in early 46, same with Ryle.
Well, I knew about it, but I can't tell you the date.
Yeah.
I don't remember just when it was. It may have been a year afterward.
But it's certainly true that when you first detected the sun in 43, that you didn't know about Hay or Southwards.
No.
Because you didn't have access to those reports.
No, I didn't have access to any of those things. See, several people could have been called the discoverers of solar radio waves, including the Germans.
Sure,
sure. All independently. And they all came to light later.
Right.
And Southworth wrote me that the only reason he was able to get that article his published in the Journal of the Franklin Institute was because I had already published mine.
I see, that was the final reason the military let him do it?
Yeah, that is, he had written up all this stuff and attempted to get it published. And it had been knocked back by the military.
Yeah.
And that must have been shortly after he discovered it, whenever it was, in late 42. And then my stuff appeared in 1944, whenever it was. And at that point, then, he went back and made further representations to the military, mm-hmm. and he said that they finally condescended to allow him to publish it, providing he expurgated all the on the equipment. He was very annoyed, undoubtedly.
Right. But if you look at his paper, though, he's very clever. You can read off on the charts and still see exactly where the frequencies are. And you can deduce the size of the antenna because he gives, from the frequency and knowing the drift scans he gives, you can mm-hmm. deduce the size of his antenna, mm-hmm. which he wasn't supposed to mention either. And you can get an idea of his sensitivity also from these charts. So
sure.
The information is there.
Yeah, if you need to know how to read it.
But it got past the sensor anyway.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned here that van der Holtz visited you, I guess, mm-hmm. in the autumn of 45. Can you tell me about that? I didn't realize that.
See, Vanderhulst, was in Holland during the period of the German occupation, and I gather things were sort of unhappy in that period. And I guess the astronomers had to go out and dig in the garden to raise vegetables to get something to eat, the general level. Anyhow, according to Vanderhulst, I gather it was Oort that was cognizant of this transition in the hyperfine structure.
Well, no, I've gotten that whole story from Vanderhulst. I can tell it to you.
Well, that's all right.
It was actually he that found it. Oort said, try to see if you can find a line.
I see.
And Vanderhulst went out and actually found the transition and worked up the details.
Well, in any case, he showed up shortly after the war, in late 45 or early 46.
At the Yerkes?
At Yerkes.
Mm-hmm.
He was some kind of a visiting scientist,
mm-hmm.
and he was making a tour of America, apparently. He didn't come immediately to Yerkes. I think he'd been to Harvard and Princeton and some other places, and he was came out to Yerkes. And of course, at that time, the fellows at Yerkes were very cognizant of what I was doing,
mm-hmm.
and so he hadn't been there more than a few days, and they brought him down just to me.
I see.
I don't remember who all came with him. It was two or three other people. And so, at that time, I was trying to build a 480 megacycle receiver that would get something. And it was already evident that the sensitivity was going to have to be pretty good. And he wanted to know what I thought of the possibility of detecting something at 1420 megacycles. And I took a rather dim view of it because it looked to me as though it was beyond the present technological capability.
Right.
And then I tried to question him, and it really was more an idea than a theory. That is, here was this transition in hydrogen, and there was hydrogen out in space, and I couldn't get out of him, and he didn't know whether this transition was going to show up in emission, whether energy was being fed into it, or whether it was going to show up in absorption, like Hartmann's lines of calcium.
Right.
And where to find it, he gave me the obvious answer. He looked toward the center of the Milky Way. Well, okay, it is a theory of a sort, see, but not the kind of thing that you knock yourself out on.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't do anything about it until quite a bit later. And I think I mentioned later I built some sequence generator and stuff.
Well, let me first ask you, you say that if the line were going to be an absorption, it would be practically hopeless. If an emission, there might be some possibility.
Well, it just looked to me as though...
I don't see what the reason. What was the reasoning for that?
Well, maybe not any very good reason, but you can always detect something better than you can detect nothing. That's all.
Okay, so you weren't thinking in terms of, like we do now, of a profile where you compare off-frequency with on-frequency.
No.
You were just thinking of a single channel.
No. Didn't I mention how I was going to do this?
I don't think so. Let's see. You talk about building the signal generator,
mm-hmm.
and that the GE lighthouse tubes would not be satisfactory. Sylvania tube. You have a multi-stage amplifier. Provided that the amplifier was good enough to detect the continuum, it seemed likely that a fairly strong absorption line might be detected. If the line were to appear in emission, then so much the better.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I get the idea that that's just a stronger signal.
That's all.
I see. It's not a matter of the contrast between online and offline. The tire setup was never completed because you moved away in 47.
Did I mention anything in there about echo box?
Yeah. You said insert the echo box in the chain.
That's the tuned system, tuned piece.
Which would give you the resonance at 1420?
Yeah.
Right.
In other words, the idea was, if you come in here with your antenna, you go through an amplifier, see a broadband amplifier. That thing ultimately got partially built,
mm-hmm.
with these rocket tubes, I think. I got, 13 dB per stage on about, 15 megacycles.
Uh-huh.
Anyhow, then this was to go into a diode detector. Just conventional, then down through DC amplifier meter. That was for running the continuum. Now, if you could find a continuum, presumed all this worked, then you put a highly selective tuned circuit right in here.
Mm-hmm.
And this tuned circuit was adjustable.
So you had a filter.
That's right.
Yeah, see? Essentially, yeah.
And this echo box was nothing but a filter, an adjustable tuned filter.
Right.
And then you would tune this filter along until you found a bump in the output.
Right.
That was the idea.
I see.
And I took some pictures of the echo box just recently. It's pretty big. It's about this big in diameter, about that tall. It's one I got on the surplus market. Somehow, I don't remember the details how, but it was used in some military capacity, which I don't remember or don't know even. Anyhow, it had a Q of about 70,000. Now, if you take
1,400 and the
1,400 megacycles,
1,000.
That's 14.
That's a 50th of a megahertz.
And divide that by 70,000. That's about 20
kilohertz. Yeah.
So it would give pretty good resolution.
That's right. It would be just about right. Very, very optimum.
It is, I don't know.
As it turned out.
It just turned out it would have been about
optimum. Lines are 100 kilohertz wide often.
I see.
But you had no switching technique here.
No, there wouldn't go be any switching technique.
So it would have to be very stable to detect a 1% line or something like that.
Probably would have had to been pretty stable.
Did you work at all on... in conjunction with the Dutch on this, or was this all sort of independently after Van Hulst went away?
This was all built after Van Hulst left.
So you just thought it might be a good idea to do?
Yeah.
You might well have continued with it if you hadn't moved away.
That's right. See, there were a lot of conflicting things. That is, the place I was living at was deteriorating. My parents had died, and my brother wanted his money out, and so did I. In other words, we'd like to liquidate this place.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, the city was growing, and they had installed an automobile parking lot next door, and there were cars, more and more cars in motion all the time, and the general environment was getting poorer and poorer to do anything like this.
Right.
So there were these various pressures, you might say, to close up and get out, and the only place that was offering at the time was the Bureau of Standards. If these pressures hadn't been present, in the next year or so, I would have finished this up.
I see. Okay?
And one of the, promises I got going to NBS was I would have facilities to do these things. It didn't materialize.
Right.
And so nothing more was done. It probably would have worked, I don't know.
Had a good chance anyway, certainly.
Yeah. But you can see, this was not the way to do it, really. But I was in a rut. That is, I had built these other things in this fashion, the wideband amplifiers. The way to do this is the way it's done now with a super heterodyne and put the selectivity in DIF system.
Right, right. It's always, hindsight's always very easy to
people
have.
Ask me when I about this microwave stuff in 1937-1938 what IF frequency I used. And I said, didn't you have any IF frequency?
Right.
And they look at me sort of blank-like, and I say, well, it was just a total power detector output amplifier system. And the reason, of course, is there was no local oscillator.
Right.
This klystron thing hadn't yet been invented.
Right, that was during the war. Yeah.
There wasn't any. There was no possibility of building a super heterodyne. There were only two tubes, one this magnetron, one this Barkhausen tube. And neither of those were continuous wave oscillators in the sense that we have continuous wave oscillators. They're more like spark oscillators. That is, they produced oscillations, but they weren't a continuous wave. They were a broad spectrum of waves.
So a continuous stream of sparks?
Old spark transmitter produced this bunch of transients.
Right.
Which were independent oscillations around some center frequency determined by the tuned circuit. Okay? So you got a flock of sidebands is what you got. Okay? Well, that's all these magnetrons and Barkhausen tubes did, the same kind of a thing.
Okay? And so it was a continuous stream of sparks, though, to make it a continuous signal, more or less, in two wide band. Like
the Barkhausen tube is originally originated by old Barkhausen, was a triode, where this was the filament, and this was the grid, and this was the plate. And this was made minus, and this was made plus. And you put a tuned circuit in here between the grid and the plate with silver blocking condensers. And this grid, of course, had interstices in it. And so an electron was attracted by the positive charge, but it went through a hole in the grid and came up here and then was repelled by the negative charge in the plate and fell back onto the grid. And if everything was adjusted properly, the time, this time, was equal to one cycle of this time.
I see.
But these things weren't all doing the same. Some of them, you know, maybe were coming up real close, and some of them were coming up not so far because they had different thermal velocities. And furthermore, this thing wasn't symmetrical. Mechanically, it was irregular.
Right.
So
right.
It didn't produce continuous waves, only sort of like continuous waves.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Speaking of tubes and such, it just came to mind the work of Potapenko. And you may be interested that he's still alive, actually.
Yes.
And I talked to him in Pasadena last summer. He told me about the experiments that he had done with this fellow named Folland. But did you know about these in the 30s, or did you only learn about them later on?
I think I learned about them later on. I remember now. I didn't know about them at that time. The way they came to light was that after Canaan had been down there a couple of times and Greenstein had been along. See, Greenstein came from out there somewhere. Or did he?
Well, no,
he was out there anyhow.
Well, eventually he ended up at Caltech. I can't remember exactly when, but...
Anyhow, I'm pretty sure I learned about him through Greenstein.
I see.
Because Greenstein showed me some pictures that Folland or Potapenko had given him of an old Chev or a Ford or something.
Right.
Or some,
I've gotten copies of those. You might like to see them this evening. I had that.
Yeah, well, I saw those pictures from Greenstein, and that's how I learned about it.
I see. But you didn't know about it in the 30s. No. Well, I have a couple other questions on the papers, the early papers especially. But are there any other points that I've missed that you'd like to comment on in these early days?
Boy, I don't know.
As to influences on your work, or what was motivating you to... I think I've covered most of the major things that
I've
been to.
Probably, see, at the University of Chicago, there were a lot of professors down there that looked upon the students as a necessary nuisance.
It still happens.
But Arthur Holly Compton had a rather more benign look upon students.
He was the head of the physics department?
No. Henry Gordon Gale was head of the physics department. Compton was some kind of an honorary professor. They gave him an extra stipend out of...
Right. He was above it all.
Anyhow, he seemed to enjoy the company of young people in a fashion that most of the old folkies down there didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so, he just didn't talk to me, but he seemed to be interested in talking to all the young people. And he wasn't bigoted in the sense some of those guys were down there. That is, some of those fellows like Dempster couldn't think about anything except their damn mass spectroscopy.
Yeah, just their own little narrow.
But Compton was interested in the things, or liked to hear about the things that the young people were thinking about. And that didn't mean that they had to think about what he and his group mate were doing, because what they were doing was high energy physics for these cutoff things. And Compton himself was doing some cosmic ray stuff.
Right.
I wasn't interested in either one of them. But I remember we used to talk about things in general, and he had a rather open mind compared to, say, Kuiper. And Compton said, we've got very limited senses, and that our comprehension of what is coming down from the sky is really quite limited.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, in that day, all we had was a few cosmic ray particles, which nobody knew where they were coming from, and light.
Right.
And that as our technology improves, we probably find that the Earth is being bombarded by a lot of different kinds of rays and particles, which we have no comprehension of today.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this was rather open outlook on life compared to some of the dogmatic things we got out of the others. And I can remember discussing with him about science and scientists. And what made a scientist go? That is, why was a scientist a scientist? Why did he do these things he did? I hazarded the guess that the reason the scientist was a scientist was probably because science was today's outlet for adventure. In the 16th century, if you wanted adventure, you joined Magellan or Columbus or Balboa or somebody. But those opportunities were long since closed. And science presented an opportunity for adventure. And he countered with the proposition that he thought, well, that was maybe part of it. Some people, he said, thought scientists liked science because it represented knowledge. But that wasn't true. That if all you were interested in was knowledge, all you had to go down the library, there was an unending amount of it down there. But he sort of agreed that the adventure of the discovery of knowledge, in other words, it was the thing which pushed the scientist along.
It was the process.
It wasn't the knowledge in itself.
Right.
It was the making of it.
Right.
Thing.
Right.
That was his opinion. And I thought this probably was about as deep an insight into the whole affair as any I had seen. I haven't forgotten him. I thought he was a very, well, worthwhile influence at the university. It is unfortunate that he and some others down there got at loggerheads with the president. But, that fellow's name, the president down there at that time, they had several of them. But anyhow, they imported this young fellow, Hutchins, from, I don't know, Princeton. And he looked down on scientists. They were a modern day kind of alchemists that were degrading society.
Right.
And that he thought that the intellectual kind of stuff which should be dispensed at a great university should be connected with the great thoughts of the great men of the past. And so he was going to teach courses in the classics, which he did, I guess fairly effectively. But he was just as empty and bigoted on his old classics as Dempster was on his spectrographs. And consequently, he didn't know what was going on in the science laboratories and cared less. And I'm pretty damn sure that Hutchins didn't know what was going on under the stadium when they were doing those things there.
Yeah, yeah.
And not because he couldn't find out, but he didn't care.
Right. He had no interest. Yeah.
But anyway. So there was a schism between the high management is represented by Hutchins and the management of the more mundane physics and chemistry and biology departments. Too bad, but that's the way it was.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, that's very interesting. And of course, Compton was very right.
I thought that he was one of the better ones they had down there, really.
Well, moving to some specific questions. In your Proceedings of the IRE article in 1940, you quote an upper limit for the sun. You try to detect the sun, and you said you don't find it. And yet this level is about one quarter of the level which you actually finally detected in 1943. Mm. Now, do you attribute that just to the fact that the measurements were so rough in terms
of absolute
intensities?
Yeah. If you've decided that's a quarter, I'll accept it.
Right. Well, it comes out. It doesn't surprise you at all.
No, it doesn't surprise me. Okay. It's within a reasonable range.
Right. And I suppose that the upper limits that you give for other astronomical objects that you looked at, like Mars and Venus and so forth, that those should also be corrected for the antenna size, beam size, and this sort of thing. You were assuming the same parameters for those others. Okay. Okay, I've already asked you about that and that. Okay. Here, I don't quite understand what you mean in this sentence when you say, you've tried to get Vega, Antares, Mars, no avail.
While some fine structure of radiation pattern seems to be present, the existing equipment is not adequate for its accurate resolution.
Well,
what did
I
you mean there?
All I'm saying there is that on these, see, at this stage, I think I was still doing it by hand, wasn't I?
Yes, plotting it every minute.
Okay. If you look at all these little wiggles, see, that's what I call the fine structure.
Okay, well, and you're talking about really a fine structure in what we now would call a drift skin.
That's right.
See? I see.
In other words, this fine structure, I suppose, in today's reading of it, would say that it was a structure which was commensurate with the resolution of the antenna. That would be today's reading of it. The reading of it as of that time would be the wiggles shown in the curve.
Right.
See? And these wiggles didn't repeat. And so you couldn't say that these wiggles had any meaning.
Right. But then you also say, though, that that the equipment is not adequate for its resolution. Mm-hmm. Now, you were thinking perhaps that it was, if you had a larger antenna, that the signal would become stronger.
I don't know. Could have been.
Or do you mean that the sensitivity wasn't enough?
While some fine structure of radiation pattern seems to be present, the existing equipment is not adequate for its accurate resolution. No conclusive measurements have been made on any of the extra
glass. Well, maybe resolution here doesn't mean angular resolution. It means the resolution of the problem as to whether it's real or not.
That probably is, probably, you see, the equipment was not adequate for its...
For the fine structure's accurate resolution.
Well, repeatability, I think, would be a better word.
I see.
See?
Not adequate to make it repeatable. In other words, it's sort of down on the noise.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Okay. Now, in figure 2 in this paper...
Figure 4?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is the next paper. Moving on to the next paper. I was wondering... Why these curves are so smooth? Were they made up of 1 minute dots also?
Yeah, they're made of 1 minute dots.
And you just didn't show the dots.
But you can see that they're pretty darn straight.
Mm-hmm. So you just drew a smooth curve through them. Okay. Okay. Here's a small question, but here you quote a 162 megahertz frequency, mm-hmm. and all the other papers you say 160 megahertz. You remember how that came about?
No, I don't.
It doesn't seem to jibe with your Wheaton article either, but it's not an important question, so don't worry about it.
I may have run some of these at 162, and I may have run some of them at 160. I can't tell at this late date.
That could be also, yeah. Okay, 1942, your IRE paper.
I'm thinking about it. We were talking about this hydrogen line and Van de Hulst.
Right.
And I found out later that this thing had been independently exploited in the laboratory at Columbia by Robbie.
Mm-hmm.
You know about that.
He measured it accurately in 48 or 49, right.
Yeah.
That was what Ewan and Purcell were working on. They had a very accurate frequency.
Yeah.
Indeed, yeah. Van der Hulst calculated 1411 megahertz,
something
I think.
Like that. Yeah.
Now, in the 1942 paper, all of these photographs, are these still existing in your
Oh, fantastic. And all the equipment's still existing, too.
The actual so if the photographs weren't, you could take new ones, right?
Yeah. Matter of fact, I have. The only thing that's not existing is that drum.
Is this you up here, by the way?
No, that's one of my helpers.
Yeah, it didn't look like you.
No.
Okay, so it's no...
This is the rear axle of a Model T Ford truck.
I see.
So I used Model T parts, and these universal joints and stuff, I think, are all parts of Model Ts. And the splines that went into them and all that are parts of Model Ts.
I see.